Welcome to the Kindling's Muse podcast, an intelligent, imaginative, hospitable exploration of ideas that matter in contemporary life. And now, here's your host, Dick Staub.
Well, this is Dick Staub. I want to welcome you to Kindling's Muse tonight. I am your so-called host. And tonight we're going to discuss the subject, Oh, the Horrors, Vampire and Zombie Movies. A genre, a commentary on our culture, and on us. Listen to that dead sign. Oh, dead.
Living dead.
The living dead Night are up. With us tonight. Well, our guest tonight will be Jeffrey Overstreet, who is a film critic, an author of numerous books, most of the titles of which I cannot pronounce. But he's got one coming out that I can pronounce. But go ahead and tell us what it is, Jeff.
The Ale Boys Feast. So
the Ale Boys
ale?
Feast.
You enjoy feast. There you go.
Good. Jenny Spohr is with us. He's the producer of The Kindling's Muse, a film critic, ordained Presbyterian clergy, and the giant, well, I didn't mean giant pumpkin.
What?
She's dressed like a pumpkin tonight. We'll take a photo and put it on the
I'm
website.
I'm a little orange tonight.
Yeah, go to thekindlings.com and you'll see why.
I could also be in a Bollywood movie. In
a
the
Bollywood
orange.
Movie?
I could. That could also be.
And we could all dance.
We could. If there was a fountain, we would
okay,
dance.
And first timer, Dr. Christine Chaney, Associate Professor of English and Chair of the English Department at Seattle Pacific University, who has lowered herself to this level to join us tonight on the Kindling's Muse. Well, we're glad you're all here. And looking forward to this conversation. Jenny.
Yes, sir.
You've been producing this show for a while. You know the things that I'm interested in talking about.
Yes, I do.
What in the world possessed you to bring us this subject tonight? Why did you decide this was a good subject to do?
Well, first off, it's October.
So is it postpartum or something?
Thematic. No, that'd be way postpartum. But no, you know, the culture right now is kind of obsessed with vampires and zombies. I don't know if you've noticed this, but there's this.
I live on Orcas Island. We don't. We are all zombies and there. So.
Yeah, little book series called Twilight. Maybe you've heard of.
Yeah, we did a show on that.
We did. Yes, yeah. Pride and Prejudice and Zombies was one of the New York Times bestseller. There's a new book actually that's just out in England called Warm Bodies, and it's like the Twilight for zombie lovers. So I mean. This genre is kind of going crazy right now, and so I thought we would talk about why these monsters right now. I mean, why not the werewolves? Why not the UFOs? Why not the crazy robots?
Okay, thank you, Jenny. Well, that's the end of the show, folks. We hope you enjoyed it.
Thank you.
Jeff, how would you describe this niche? Why is this so important, and how popular is it within film?
I think we love to be scared, and I think that's a healthy thing. Because it affirms for us that there is a way things are supposed to be. And in the larger cultural discussion about religion and about faith, and the debate between science and religion, it's become very unpopular to talk about right and wrong and good and evil. But something in us needs that affirmation that there is a way things are supposed to be. There is a beautiful, mysterious thing that a human being is supposed to be. And so when we see something that's sort of not quite right in a zombie or a vampire, someone driven by appetite, someone who's lost discernment, someone who's lost grace.
Appetite to eat other humans, Jeff.
Right, yes. A particular appetite. Baser appetite.
Or blood.
I mean, you were making it sound so intellectual there for a minute.
Yeah.
Shaun of the Dead. It's about a philosophical.
And I just had a burger, so
you know, my gosh.
I'm slipping.
Cheers. That's right.
But no, I think, when I was a kid, I loved The Three Little Pigs because I loved the big bad wolf. He was scary. I put the poster for Jaws on my wall, even though I wasn't allowed to see that movie as a kid because I was so frightened by the picture. You know, there's something about
you,
that.
You wanted to be frightened.
I wanted to be frightened. There was something in me that needed that it was a healthy emotion.
Yeah.
So I think that's good for us.
Okay. We have some counselors in the hallway. Their business cards will be circulated for any of you that... Okay,
that's good.
By the way, did you guys know that by 2005, Dracula is the subject of more films than any other fictional character in film history? So maybe you're right. Maybe there is a fascination here. Now, Chris, Dr.
Yes.
Chris.
Oh, yes, Dr. Chris, please.
I was looking at your background, and you have this interest in narrative strategies of truth-telling and their intersection with the beautiful.
Don't hold it against me, Dick.
And the good. And now you're with us talking about vampires and zombies. What happened to you?
I'm coming to the people. That's all I can say. Yeah, this is great. But, you know, I take a little exception with what Jeff just said.
All right.
Even though he's my pal.
It's getting good already.
You know, these kind of stories.
But you got a PhD.
I know. So I'm sorry. I'll try. Don't hold it against me. Mostly, these are great mythic stories. And there are ways to talk about good and evil in metaphoric and allegorical ways, too. So not just...
ways?
Allegorical. Oh, okay, like allegory.
I also don't have a PhD.
Yeah, well, okay. But, you know, it's not just that we love to be scared. That's true. But there are ways to make political critiques. There's ways to talk about the brokenness of society in ways that, you know, if you have a zombie eating someone's arm, that in a way gives you a fairy tale or a sort of mythic way instead of talking about police brutality in Selma, Alabama, for example.
Okay. Mythic... serious themes, archetypal themes. Good to get some quick feedback from the audience. If you agree that this genre is created because of some deep, important intellectual need and spiritual need in our lives, I'm going to ask you to clap in just a moment. If you think what you've heard so far is a bunch of hooey, I want you to yell boo.
Booey.
Okay,
hooey.
So here, how many of you think that Jeff and these people are on the right track? People. Let's hear a lot of clapping. How many of you think this is a bunch of hooey? Woo-hoo! All right. We got a show. So let's start with Shaun of the Dead, that great intellectual
Woo-hoo!
Masterpiece.
Yes.
A man decides to turn his moribund life around by winning back his ex-girlfriend, reconciling his relationship with his mother, and dealing with an entire community that's returned from the dead to eat the living. Okay. Jeff. Knock it out of the park, buddy.
Well, we're starting with a film that is at once a send-up of zombie movies and a very respectful homage to zombie movies. But you also have to back up and see that the director, Edgar Wright, did a television series called Spaced, which is fantastic, by the way. It's one of the funniest sitcoms I've ever seen. And it's about a bunch of slackers who sit around and watch a bunch of movies, watch a bunch of television, play a lot of games. And then they go out into their lives, and their stories start taking the shape of these things they're watching.
Yes,
they celebrate the conventions of the standoff, or the zombie movie, or the X-Files kind of conspiracy. Each episode sort of has its own genre it's paying tribute to, and those characters find meaning in their lives when these supposedly worthless genres that they're spending time with, or video games they're spending time with, start connecting to and shaping their understanding of their daily lives. So Shaun of the Dead was rather like that, in that even though it took a lot of the same cast, Simon Pegg, Nick Frost, Jessica Stevenson, gave them new characters, it also took the genre of the zombie movie and made it a way of talking about what they were becoming by becoming merely consumers and slackers. Nick Frost's character never really recovers from that.
No.
He's just this
so it's
slovenly.
It's a critique of slackers.
As a friend.
Well, of slackers and a lot of other things going on in that consumer culture. But it also revels in what they love about that genre by just going for the gore, going for the monsters in ways that not even all serious zombie movies have had the guts to do. So what I love about it, though.
Wait, serious zombie movies versus comedic.
Right. The serious zombie stuff. The zombies are not made fun of so much in this film. They're pretty much like most zombies. The buffoons who are fighting them, however, are as much about us as any good political zombie movie. But my favorite scene in the film, for example.
I see this song now, Bring Out the Buffoons.
Pretty much.
The clowns.
With the chain around their neck.
So Simon Pegg's character and Nick Frost's character in the backyard, and a zombie is making his way toward them.
Yeah.
And they have to figure out, well, what can we fight him with? Well, all we've got is this old shed. Well, what's in the shed? Well, my old records. Okay. Well, we can throw the records at the zombie. And they throw one, and it sticks in his forehead. And they get in an argument over which records can they bear to part with.
How do you throw, in modern times, an MP3 file at a zombie?
Right. It's already outdated.
Yeah. But, we got a problem here.
It's a great zombie movie and a hilarious spoof of them at the same time.
Right. So, intelligent women, what... do Jenny and Chris have to add about this?
I want to add one quick thing, if I could, and that is the Englishness, the really, really profound Englishness of that movie. He uses a cricket bat. It's about the pub culture. It's about football. It's about drinking. And how it's a kind of a celebration of English slackerdom, particularly, and sort of celebrating that. And I got to like that.
The celebration of English slackerdom.
That's
Nigel Goodwin, ladies and gentlemen.
beer okay. and chips and the,
which
you
they
know.
Did even more in Hot Fuzz, the next film they
right.
made, which
oh
was
yeah.
a spoof
right.
of police movies and action films.
Yep. Yeah. Got it. Yeah. Jenny.
You know, I love Shaun of the Dead because I just love, you know, Simon Pegg and all that stuff. Hot Fuzz is one of my favorite movies. But I really do see a little bit deeper in that film is, you're
yes.
giving me a
please,
face.
Jenny.
That we are, echoing what they're saying, we are sort of sleepwalking through our lives. I mean, he goes up, he goes to his work at the big box grocery store, and, you know, basically the 23-year-old clerk mouths off to him, and he's like, what have you done with your life, buddy? And Simon's Pegg character is like, I'm only 30, you know? And the sense of that he's not taking his life by the horns and living it the way that he wants to, and okay. yet these zombies wake him up to the life he wants
okay,
to live.
Okay, two questions. Number one, what is your sense of the intentionality of the filmmaker about a serious critique and their choice of this genre? I mean, that's an important point, but why would you choose this genre to make that point as opposed to any number of other genres?
Because it's funny. No, go ahead.
Right. I think he relates to slackers, but I think at the end he's affectionate toward them because Nick Frost, have you seen the movie? Can I spoil things? Okay. Well, one of the main characters becomes a zombie, and becomes sort of like a house pet at the end because he can't
right.
bear to kill him. He can't, right. he can't bear to completely ruin him and lose him.
Right.
So he's sort of a, becomes a house pet while the other slackers are learning some responsibility and having the guts to fall in love and things like that.
Okay.
So
and the audience, you know, what percentage of the audience do you perceive is actually engaged in this kind of deeper philosophical critique? And what percent are just sitting there, hey, this is funny, man? I mean, what's going on with an audience around a film like this?
Yeah, I think a lot of the audience probably is not getting the deeper cultural commentary. Although,
stoned.
When
are
we the, talk about Night of the Living Dead, I think that's
to this,
different.
Are those people listening to this and saying, these guys are nuts?
No,
this is just a funny movie.
They can't,
it has nothing
possibly.
To do with what these guys
they
are
can't
saying.
They can't afford a laptop to download podcasts.
Yeah.
Oh, Jeff,
but
that was
we,
low.
Oh, ouch,
that was very low.
But what we always talk about on the show, though, is, look, you've got to invest in culture and look at culture intentionally. And so yeah. that's what we're always promoting on the show. So yeah, even yeah. a hilarious zombie movie can have layers like an onion.
Yeah, you're reminding me
Thank
of when
donkey.
I interviewed Margaret Atwood, and I asked her, so when you wrote Handmaid's Tale, how did Christians respond to it? And she said, oh, Christians don't read, you know.
Oh.
I mean, Jeff, Ouch. They don't have laptops, you know, Dex.
Well, that's
These
right.
unsophisticated
oh,
people.
Oh, my gosh.
Okay, Night of the Living Dead.
Yeah.
Jenny.
No, I think
we
switched
Chris.
That.
We
I'm
going to
talk
oh,
about
Chris.
That one. That's
She's
right.
All about it.
Have another beer, Dick.
Yeah. Night of the Living Dead is sort of the beginning of the zombie genre, really. I mean, zombies, not to get all professorial on you, but they exist in West African culture. That word is an African word. It's an ancient kind of voodoo term. But Night of the Living Dead, 1968, George Romero, is considered the beginning of zombie films in culture. And the story is a very simple one. It is brother and sister go to a cemetery, slow, eerie music, black and white in 1968, slow pan as they went to take flowers to their father's grave, and some kind of weird old guy walking slow going, oh, starts walking toward them.
Kind of like your typical pastor.
There you go. And essentially, they run, he eats the brother, and the entire rest of the film is the sort of farm, rural farmhouse in Pennsylvania with the vaguely spacey, I hope we're going to get into some of the dumb women in some of
no,
these movies.
Geez.
That's a whole
Feel
other
free.
Thing.
Dumb yeah. women in this movie.
Dumb They're blonde, dumb. Definitely a dumb blonde here, who goes into shock, and essentially, you have this farmhouse out in the countryside, the zombies start coming and surrounding, and various people are hiding there, and the key figure is a tall African-American man who is the most rational, the strongest leader, the best, you know, sort of savior of everyone, who you know, you have all these kind of archetypes happening, and at the very end, he's the only one who survives through all the various zombie adventures, only to be shot through the head by the sheriff and the posse coming to rescue people because they saw his movement in the window and literally pile him on the top of the dead body.
So
with
what's
the hook.
Redemptive storyline there?
Not much.
It's
shooting the one guy.
The one guy. Well, they didn't know, but they
How
saw...
How does this fit the archetype of you know.
Yeah, these kind of stories. Well, it's this menace, you know, it's the societal breakdown, the kind of menace. 1968, a lot of rioting, a lot of social unrest. And you have this sort of quasi-scientific handheld camera, some documentary, DEA Pennybaker type images, the White House. And essentially, you have this idea that society is run amok, you know, rioting and assassinations.
Yeah, like Kent State.
Kent State, the Robert Kennedy assassination.
So well, and it's go ahead.
I was going to say, it's a satellite that has exploded in space that has caused the zombies.
Radiation, yes.
There's radiation everywhere, and that's what makes people zombies. So it is this sort of fear of this scientific exploration of space. Right. And then, of course, what do you do with the black hero at the end? The lynch mob has to get him.
And yet, all the information that's flooding in through TV, the hero doesn't really pay a whole lot of attention to that. He focuses on trying to help the people in the house.
Well, so
exactly,
if it's satellite that caused the problem, and satellites were kind of, you know, people were starting to notice them in the 60s and so forth, the 70s. Is this movie kind of taking a stand against technological advance, that it's got dangers? Or
well, it's a little bit... The zombies can't, in some of the social commentary in that film, the zombies can be representative of the new youth culture that
Absolutely.
Is coming up and sort of
they're
attacking
spaced, they're spaced
the new.
Out.
Yeah, they're the spaced
they're
out, they're
druggy,
the space age
like
kids,
wood.
And they're going to come and overtake.
Right.
Okay, here's what the description online is after you've heard all our intellectual comments. The radiation from a fallen satellite might have caused recently deceased people to rise from the grave and seek the living to use as food.
Yes.
Ladies and gentlemen.
That's it.
Intellectual premise.
Oh, that's it.
Anybody else want to comment on that one? Jeff?
I think that one of the reasons it's lasted is that when it opened to audiences of children. Because there was no MPAA code yet. And Ebert, if you go back and read Roger Ebert's original review of this, he talks more about the experience of being in that theater than actually seeing the movie. And he's horrified by it. And he says, I felt real terror in that neighborhood theater last Saturday afternoon. I saw kids who had no resources they could draw upon to protect themselves from the dread and fear they felt. And imagine, you know, like a 9-year-old watching the hero get shot in the head at the end of the movie as the police move in, what that does to that eventual teenager's cynicism or eventual college student's cynicism.
I understand that the research shows they grow up to love zombie movies.
Probably.
So you all saw it when you were 9, did you?
Yeah.
So I think it made a pretty big impression on its initial audience, and then the MPAA code came in right after that. And yet Ebert argues that censorship isn't the answer.
Right.
But he does say... In a case like this, I want to know what the parents were thinking of when they dumped the kids in front of the theater to see a film titled Night of the Living Dead. So already he's thinking about the difference between
that. But if you look at the literary genre that of children's literature, has always had horrific characters and scary characters. So what's wrong with kids going? If they're archetypal stories that have serious import, why would we be concerned about taking kids to them?
George Romero says these came from comic books. Tales of the Crypt were comic books. And so this was considered a comic book film when it came out. And that's why kids, you know, were like, oh, it's just like that monster comic book you read, son. Yeah. But the deal was, I don't know, I was only in third grade in 1968, but I hear from folks that people felt like that was the end of the world. This is sympathy for the double time. This is like the America is on fire, you know, Mississippi burning. And I have the sense that it articulates the sense that every apocalypse is what zombie movies are about. They are about the end of the world as we know it. And so it's some. I think what we can read is that Romero was in black and white quasi-documentary type shooting saying, what if this is the apocalypse?
It's No Country for Old Men. It's a precursor to No Country for Old Men, where the lawmen are not the answer. They're contributing to the problem.
Oh, man, yes.
I'm looking something up because you're reminding me of something that I just looked at this weekend. I can't find it right now, but it's a Walker Percy quote about how the end is upon us, but it's not, you know, we don't anticipate that we're in the end times when we're in the end times, and that these films are an early warning system, actually, I guess you're saying. Well, so now let's go to the next film on our list, Jenny. The 28 Days Later.
Yeah, that's actually a really good segue into 28 Days Later. 28 Days Later is by Oscar award-winning filmmaker Danny Boyle. He won the Oscar for Slumdog Millionaire. He also made Trainspotting, Sunshine, Millions, which is a movie we talked about on the show quite a bit.
And the upcoming 127 Hours, which is going to open in a few weeks.
Yeah, and so you know that this movie is going to be a little bit more deep because it's Danny Boyle. This movie starts with monkeys in a lab, and monkeys are watching video clips of all the...
Jenny, you understand you just said, you know it's Danny Boyle, it's going to be a more serious movie. This movie starts with monkeys in a lab. I mean, you know, Ronald Reagan monkeys. Had a monkey in a lab. Yeah, right. I mean, Jerry Lewis had a monkey in a lab.
Oh, well,
I'm sorry, go ahead.
Reagan's scary in later, actually, in the vampire
By
stuff.
By the way, I'm just being a devil's advocate. I love these movies. Go ahead.
Yeah. Monkeys are in a lab, and they're strapped to beds, and they're watching all the horrific clips of violence and war and police brutality, and they're surrounded by these TV screens. And basically, what these scientists are researching is rage and how you can create rage. And so scientists have distilled rage, the actual emotion, into its core, and it is now flowing through the bloodstream of these monkeys. These monkeys get out, bite humans, and that's what turns you into a zombie. And what's interesting about these zombies, too, unlike some of the other zombie films you'll see, these zombies are just really, really mad. And they're not they're not out to eat you. They're just out to kill you. So it's not, you know, Night of the Living Dead, they're eating
cannibals,
these dead people.
Yeah.
You know, these zombies are eating people. But this isn't
I'm
about...
Sure that is comforting to their victims.
Oh, well, yeah.
They don't want to eat me. They
exactly.
just want to kill me.
And that's what's so, though, intriguing about it is that it's it really is. He's showing the effects of, you know, what our world is doing to us that it would create this. But he's also making this film in the middle of the... foot and mouth disease in England. He's a British man. Some of these infectious diseases that are they're going around the world and people are really afraid of and they don't know what to do about. And so he's delving into both of those things in this film.
Now, Danny Boyle doesn't have any other films in this genre, does he?
Not zombies. I
mean, well, he has a film called Shallow Grave, which is about how people are turned into monsters when they see the opportunity to grab some money.
Well, you know, but it's interesting because you're talking about the historical context in both of these last films. So the filmmaker, one could argue that they're making their decision on the genre based on what's happening in real life, or one might argue that this is a hot genre, and if I could possibly make a film in that genre, it'd be great because I'd make money.
He calls himself a smuggler. He says, I think about what people are going to want to see when they get off work on Friday night. This is what he said when I asked him about Millions and how he crafts his movies, because they're both commercially very appealing, but they always give you something to think about. And he said, I see myself as a smuggler. I pay attention to what's going to draw them into the theaters on a Friday night when they don't want to think about anything, and then I trick them into actually thinking about something.
Yep.
And I thought that was great.
Hmm. Interesting. That's what we do on this show, too. Just smuggling right and left. This is Dick Staub. You're listening to Kindling's Moves. We're going to be back with some more. We're coming up on Let the Right One In, interview with a vampire, and more. And Nigel Goodwin reading a scary poem. We'll be right back. Well, this is Dick Staub back with you, and now we go to my friend Nigel Goodwin with a poetic reflection on our subject tonight.
I wait here at the boundaries of dream, all shadow-wrapped. The dark air tastes of the night, so cold and crisp. And I wait for my love. The moon has bleached the color from her stone. She'll come, and then we'll talk this pretty world alive to darkness and the tang of blood. It is a lonely game, the quest for blood, but still, a body's got the right to dream, and I'd not give it up for all the world. The moon has leached the darkness from the night. I stand in the shadows, staring at her stone, undead. My lover. Oh, undead, my love. I dreamt you while I slept today. And love meant more to me than life, meant more than blood. The sunlight sought me deep beneath my stone, more dead than any corpse, but still a dream. Until I woke as vapor into night, and sunset forced me out into the world. For many centuries, I've walked the world, dispensing something that resembled love, a stolen kiss, and then back into the night, contented by the life and by the blood. And come the morning, I was just a dream, cold body chilling underneath a stone. I said, I would not hurt you. Am I stone to leave you prey to time and to the world? I offered you a truth beyond your dreams, while all you had to offer was your love. I told you not to worry, and that blood tastes sweeter on the wing and late at night. Sometimes my lovers rise to walk the night. Sometimes they lie cold corpse beneath a stone and never know the joys of bed and blood, of walking through the shadows of the world. Instead, they rot to maggots. Oh, my love. They whispered you had risen in my dream. I've waited by your stone for half the night, but you won't leave your dream to hunt for blood. Good night, my love. I offered you the world.
Nigel, that was awesome.
Yes.
That was awesome. That's Vampire Sestina. Neil Gaiman. Is it Gaiman or Gaiman?
It's Gaiman. He's the author of the Sandman series, Coraline. Maybe you saw that.
Yeah.
Rather creepy children's film.
Yeah. It's an amazing
The Graveyard poem. Book, which won an award last year.
Yeah. Nigel, you when you heard what this show was tonight, you were interested and researched. You went off, you looked at books at Barnes and Noble. You scratched your head. So you've heard what we've discussed so far. What would you add from across the pond and with your years of experience?
I think it's great to laugh lest we cry at many things. But it is laughter, lest we cry, because I think Screwtape loves the laughter, like he loves the horns and the costume. But what he dislikes is to be unmasked, defrocked, made to be what he is, found out, because we all dislike being found out. I was thinking when Jeffrey's talking about kids' stories and others, all through the Second World War, I read about the Wicked Queen. Mirror, mirror on the wall, who is the fairest of us all? And I had nightmares. As I read these stories, I had nightmares. But the goalposts were different. And the goalposts were different for most of us when we were growing up. And I think the goalposts, it's really the drip, drip, drip Chinese torture, almost subliminal. We now listen to, engage with, and accept a very different world. So today's generation just buys into, without questioning, so much of what is being offered. And I do think that when you point the microphone at the media and they will say to you, well, we're just reflecting what's out there. We just reflect Seattle, we reflect America, England, the rest of the world. And I say, hang on a minute. Some of you are directing as well as reflecting. So my sense is that there is a dark side, and I wish the church, Christians, would wake up and truly understand the dark, because then they can bring a candle. As many of the lyrics actually out there, God isn't waiting for the church, of course. He is speaking through almost everybody today, writers, painters, artists, who have no claims to be Christian. He is speaking, and while Christians are trying to dot the I's and cross the T's and get it right, others are putting their stuff out there for audiences that are hungry. Human beings, fearfully and wonderfully made, whether they know it or not, are leaning in to modern media, leaning into these films. I was reminded of Edgar Allan Poe, because those are the films I did watch actually quite a lot, The Pit and The Pendulum. But the goalposts were different then. They were very dark. They were honestly dark. They weren't afraid to be dark. But there was still a sense of pointing us from the dark somewhere. There was still a candle in the dark, like Coldplay, like Chris Martin sings in Coldplay, lights will guide me home. So there is a way through the dark, through the dark.
Okay, so, and I talked with Nigel a bit about this earlier today after he had done his research. And the sense I got that was Nigel was getting concerned that we're treating a serious subject as entertainment and not as something that should be taken seriously. So when he talks about the earlier films, they took the dark side seriously and tried to point to some redemptive outcome. So you guys have seen these films, Shaun of the Dead, Night of the Living Dead, 28 Days Later, Let the Right One In, Interview with a Vampire. What is your, how would you respond to his observation? Are these movies making light of something that's serious? Are we laughing lest we cry? Are they in any sense offering kind of a lighting a candle in darkness? Or are they just another form of kind of an entertainment? You know, I interviewed John Grisham, and he said entertainment is anything that makes me feel. So it may make me laugh, it may make me cry, but if it's entertaining, it's going to make me feel. What's your response to Nigel?
Well, I think that there are a couple of players who have certain roles here. The director, the artist, has to be thinking about what is the responsible thing to do here. Am I just exploiting the audience's feelings and fears, or am I giving them something that they'll take away and take this more seriously when they leave? Mm-hmm. But then again, the audience, parents need to be teaching children how to read and how to discern, so that when they encounter a story in the theater or in what little narrative there is in a video game, that they will do some interpretation, that they will talk about it afterwards. Because I think a lot of these films are making us feel pretty, you know, serious pain. And if we don't think about why afterwards, then it's just a wasted experience and we're desensitized and we need more pain next time. I had a friend who walked out of his first viewing of Reservoir Dogs, which has a scene of excruciating torture in the middle. And he said, I love that movie. It made me feel more alive than I've felt in a long time. And that really disturbed me, because that told me how numb he had become. Yeah. But there was no pursuit of the conversation beyond that. On the other hand, you've got somebody like Scott Derrickson, who made a film like The Exorcism of Emily Rose, knowing full well, believing that this stuff is real in the world. You know, and he said, as a storyteller, I'm very aware that as Christians, we've lost touch with our story, which is a horror story. We are wearing a symbol around our necks that is an instrument of torture. But when people think of the church, they think of being judged by the church. They don't think of our story anymore. So it's my job to show them the conflict of good and evil in such a vivid way that they, especially by the things they don't see on the screen, are disturbed and have to go wrestle those questions. So his film had a lot less gore than, say, The Exorcist.
Yeah.
But questions that were in some ways much more disturbing.
Yeah.
So that people would talk about it. And I loved the experience of leaving that theater because everybody was saying, do you believe in that? They weren't going, oh, you remember that part when...
Yeah.
And that told
Chris,
me he'd succeeded.
Yeah.
You told me before the show that you got interested in this kind of intersection of popular culture and faith issues as a really doing serious literary studies.
Yeah.
And one of the interesting things when Nigel and I were looking for a poem for tonight, when we looked at Edgar Allan Poe, one of the poems had two words we didn't even know what they were. And so we looked them up, and they were both out of Nordic, Northern, dark,
yes.
serious literature,
right.
which is interesting because C.S. Lewis was very drawn. That's where his
right.
sense of myth was so engaged.
Right.
Tolkien the same. That kind of northernness, that darkness. That.
Right.
So how do you respond to what Nigel's saying?
It's a great point. You know, the vampire, the first sort of popular Western version is 1818. I mean, it's before Poe. It's John Polidori. And it's essentially about Byron, you know, the famous Lord Byron, and the kind of human evil that comes with sexual decadence and the kind of, you know, aristocrat who simply consumes and destroys people's
Oscar
lives.
Oscar Wilde and Dorian Gray.
And Dorian Gray is the other one. And then you have Bram Stoker, the Irishman writing Dracula, of course, in 1897. And so there's this way in which... My one counter would be that these stories take evil very, very seriously in a culture that doesn't. And so you have something like Let the Right One In, where you have this sort of serial killer trope, and then what's going on? It seems like just that sort of graphic violence, and it enters into this way of saying there's this bigger evil that, you know, comes close to almost like pedophilia, grooming your next kind of victim, that really asks us to look seriously at real brokenness in our world, I think.
So does the zombie film as a convention represent a genre that's smuggling for most of these filmmakers? In other words, there is something serious here, but they know most people in today's short attention span audience wouldn't really be able to absorb a wholly serious exploration of the subject. So they do something that's lighter, that's still trying to get at that point.
I think now, but I think back where all of these stories came from, they were coming from the passion plays. They were realizing, or the Colosseum for that matter, they realized that blood sells. And I don't know that it was so much the same thing as, you know, box office has taught us this. But they knew people would read something lurid, and then by forcing, you know, turning the mirror to the reader, saying, why are you entertained by this? You know, there's Maximus.
Yes.
Are you entertained?
Right.
I think they were aware of that.
Jenny, what would you say?
You know, I would agree that I think these movies do actually take a darker side very seriously. As well, and there's some of them that are funny and again are vehicles to get laughs. And of course, there are films out there, zombie films, vampire films, that really the director really isn't thinking deep thoughts about culture and are just trying to make some money, because that's horror films make a ton of money. But I also think it really is a way for us to explore our own decadence, our own zoning out to the world and to life in a way that's approachable.
You know, I must say, I think the idea of Slackadum coming from England to America after you have given us so much.
Yeah.
The gift that keeps on giving.
Are you going to say thank you, Nigel?
Yeah, and the idea that you might one day learn to play cricket, you know, with a bat. I mean, that's...
And you might one day understand what football really is.
This is true, Dick. But, you know... Food. We're not that far away, actually, in our so-called advancement, development. What is development? What have we developed from and for? Peace Child, the book Peace Child, written just a few years ago, was about cannibalism in Iranjaya, in the Far East. And cannibalism is not far from any one of us. So eating bodies for food is not far from any one of us in that. And in fact, with the tribe that was doing this, they were fattening you up for friendship, fattening you up. So are these movies fattening us up for friendship? Is it an invitation to take a journey with this darkness. What is, Dick asked, what is the intentionality of the writer?
I interviewed Anne Rice after she had her Christian experience, which she since said she doesn't want to be affiliated with official Christianity, but she still wants to be a Jesus follower. But it was really interesting because her return to Christianity, she was raised in a blend of Catholicism with a lot of Haitian and other influences because she was raised in New Orleans. And at the age of 16, she was weary of not being able to read the people she wanted to read. She wanted to read Kierkegaard and Sartre, and her parents were very strict and didn't let her read any of that. So she left her Catholicism, she moved away, she started school, and she married an atheist, a poet. And she said that her vampire experience was her way of exploring what it means to have chosen to leave kind of that story and to be forever exiled from it. And it was really an interesting discussion. And then she said that her return to her Christian roots was when she was studying, and this gets to your point of this is serious stuff, when she was studying the history of the Jews, because she wanted to see how Jewish history fit in with the whole genre for vampire stuff. And it occurred to her, and she had read some N.T. Wright, of all things, and it occurred to her that the only explanation for the survival of the Jews was that it was a miracle, that there was a God. Because she said, where are the Akkadians? Where are the Phoenicians? Where are all those ancient tribes? The only one that's still standing is the Jews, and we've tried to eradicate them. There are 1.1 million Jews killed in Jerusalem at AD 70, and 6 million in the Holocaust. So it was interesting to hear the way she got triggered back to, whoa, there's something real about this story, and her feeling like she was coming in out of exile, you know? So, but from her standpoint, the exploration of the vampire theme was an exploration of the dark side of that,
right,
without any possibility of a light side.
Right.
You know?
It's the Faust story. It's choosing eternal life on your own terms. And it's, don't you want, and as well as being Dorian Gray, Oscar Wilde, eternal, you know, beauty and power, but in order, you have to trade love. It's like the ring, the, you know, Wagner's ring as well. You have to give up love in order to have eternal life, but it's your damnation is the cost.
But of course, those stories were written, the Faust story, and indeed Oscar Wilde trying to expose the sign of hypocrisy of Victorian mores and that kind of thing. But I think today, when the goalposts have kind of shifted so far, and we've lived through the Holocaust, as Dick is pointing out, the really dark side, when God is off stage, if the light is shut out, then what do we have left on stage? I was reading in Barnes & Noble this morning,
he does his research.
The Guillermo del Toro and Chuck Hogan, The Fall, authors of The Strain. And their last lines in that are, the last two lines of the book are, pain will find no release. The night eternal has begun. It's almost the reverse of the Christian story. Not the day of the fullness of everything, the completeness of everything has begun, but the night
eternal. Well, and so what you're saying out of that, Nigel, earlier today was that you feel like today's films are celebrating the darkness instead of exposing it.
The cost.
And showing a light. Would you guys agree with that or not?
Some of them. I mean, sure.
Some, but you think back a couple of years, so There Will Be Blood and No Country for Old Men and The Road, and I wouldn't.
And Let the Right One In, in a sense, the horror.
Let's talk about Let the Right One In. How does that fit in this discussion?
Are we jumping to that? Okay.
Let's jump.
Yeah. And Jenny, I think you were going to.
Yeah, I can talk about Let Me In as well. Let Me In is the American remake of the foreign film Let the Right One In. It's a vampire movie, and the American version is actually very similar to the foreign film, which is great because often you don't see that
But then it begs the question, why did you even make it? You didn't really need to. But
because we're Americans and we can.
We don't want to read subtitles, exactly, apparently.
Yeah. But, Jeff, did you want to take the story? No.
Sure. It's about a young boy named Oscar who lives with his mom in this sort of tenement housing area in Stockholm. And he's very, very lonely, which is very important to the story. Mm-hmm. That explains why he would accept a friend like Eli, who moves in next door, who behaves very strangely, and who can't come into Oscar's room without being invited, and who runs out in the evening and kills people and drinks their blood. And,
and Eli's a girl.
Ellie, I believe. Excuse me.
Or Ellie, yes, is a girl.
Maybe
not. She's a female persona. So that, I mean, that adds, that's important to the story.
Help me out here. Okay.
Are there any girls anymore or any boys? Yeah.
The book goes into that question a whole lot more deeply. But the whole question of the gender of Eli really does not matter that much to Oscar. He's just so happy to have found a friend. I mean, they bond over a Rubik's Cube. You know, it doesn't really matter what they bond over. They connect. And the question is he going to remain faithful to this friend when he finds out about the friend's true nature? And as we learn about Eli and Eli's sort of partner, who's this older man who has this sort of pedophile kind of vibe going, you start to wonder, how are Oscar and Eli going to remain friends? Well, Oscar's being bullied at school. He's missing a dad. All the people around him are adults who are reckless and indulgent and don't care about him. And I started to see the film, as beautifully filmed as it is, I describe it as a Krzysztof Kieslowski horror movie, start to see it as a primer on terrorism. Because how are terrorist groups formed? They take the poor, neglected, lonely, angry youth and equip them with power to strike back. And Oscar is being taught how to care for someone who has the power he doesn't have to strike back at this adult world. And it's a heartbreaking movie. It reminded me more than anything of a great British drama called This Is England by a director named Shane Black, which was about a young man who was recruited into a violent gang of skinheads. And the films have so many interesting parallels that it makes you start to wonder, why do we single out fantasy as if it's some questionable genre? I mean, this is as realistic as anything. If anything, it's more accessible because it's boiled down to these very simple decisions, simple elements of life, and we don't have to worry too much about the historical context.
Well, and there's this great scene in the American version that is not in the other, and it talks to what Nigel was saying. The little boy is calling his dad on the phone, who's, of course, not there, and he's crying, and he says, "Dad, do you believe that there's evil?" And there's just tears coming down this little, like, 10-year-old boy's face, and he's just shaking because he's just learned, you know, what this friend of his is. And the dad just blows him off. "What's your mom been telling you? Where have you heard this? I don't want to hear you talking about this ever again. You know, this is put your mom on the phone type of thing." And here's this boy reaching out to this adult world where he thinks there's safety. It's a very powerfully shot scene.
And his dad doesn't want to face that question because he's a drunk. Yeah. And yeah.
What would you add, Chris?
That we haven't talked enough about sex.
Sorry.
That would be something an SPU professor.
Well, you know, this is my only venue.
Because that's true at SPU as well. I'm sorry.
But it's just, you know, because it's something of a subtext in that film. But you know, vampires, the original story, everything is about, it's about metaphors for sex and sexual transgression, and you know, whether it was talking about Byron, whether it's Dracula, or even Let the Right One In, really flirts. I have only seen the Swedish version, but in this female persona where she gets in bed with him, and they're right in like middle school age, where you know they're sort of that prepubescent, you know, coming of age, and you know, the slow, she takes her hand and sort of slowly runs it along his, you know, arm and hand. And it, there's all kinds of ways there's seduction going on, even with these sort of 12-year-olds. And it's about, you know, vampire movies are always about kind of that kind of transgression. And so, you know, we got to have sex if we're talking about vampires. That's all I'm saying.
And the Twilight movies, which we all mentioned.
I mean, True Blood,
terrible scripts, you know, romanticism, not romance, but you know, sitting in a field of, you know, spring flowers and, you know, picnic time. But it, you know, everybody is blonde, blue-eyed in Hollywood, or, you know, profile left on the catwalk. You know, they're all perfect for each other, you know. If you're perfect, I guess you can chew. You know, you can eat each other. You know. But you're right. I mean, it is about the falsifying of our humanity.
I got to ask a question here. Doug Gresham, C.S. Lewis's stepson, remembers going to Fantasia with C.S. Lewis. And when they left the theater, Lewis's concern was that Disney was going to take the great deep myths, skim the surface of them, tell them superficially, and not really help the audience get deeper.
And right. They did.
And they did.
Are exactly. We in that situation? Is that what our situation is? We're skimming the great myth, the archetypal stories. We're kind of mining them for the easy touch point, but not really taking them deep.
But something's changing because the young readers are starting to idolize the monsters because the monsters are powerful. And they don't feel powerful, and they don't feel loved. Bella in Twilight is a blank of a character. She's the opposite of Harry Potter. Harry Potter discovers what he can do, discovers his destiny, discovers he has these gifts, starts developing them, starts engaging this world that intimidates him.
Takes
Bella
on the dark side.
Goes looking for the most powerful guy.
But it's also true that...
And of course he loves her, even though she's a blank, so it's flattering her that the way to find, you know, a good self-image is to find someone powerful who will love you, not to grow.
We're going to take a break, Nigel. Sorry, my friend. Quick quiz for our panel here, these elite professionals. Which Hollywood actress said, when other little girls wanted to be ballet dancers, I kind of wanted to be a vampire?
Oh, I think I know.
Any guesses?
Angelina Jolie.
That's the right answer, ladies and gentlemen.
Thank you.
And she did.
And she did.
And as Jack Handy of Saturday Night Live said, the one thing vampire children are taught is never run with a wooden stick.
Hi, this is Dick Staub, your host. This just in for Homer Simpson. Lisa, vampires are make-believe, like elves, gremlins, and Eskimos. Okay, we're going now to the time of our show that we always look forward to, that question and answer time. I have to say we've got a lot of great questions tonight. And so I'm going to ask you to kind of keep your questions succinct, and maybe just one of you on the panel knock it out of the park for us, and then we'll keep moving because there's a lot of people that have questions here tonight. I should mention there were two other movies that we had hoped to get to that we didn't get to tonight. Interview with a Vampire and Nosferatu, 1922, and Werner Herzog's version of it. So if you had a question about that or want to ask a question about that and you've got one of these questions, feel free to do that. We're going to go out now and get to your questions, and we're starting. Oh, good choice, Dick. Make sure it's way back in the back. I'm going to start with Jim. Is Jim ready to knock it out of the park for us? Okay, then we'll move to another table, ladies and gentlemen. Oh. So the dyslexia strikes again. Jim, your question.
It made me think of the movie Invasion of the Body Snatchers. Does this fit into the genre? Is one of the most the 70s, the Donald Sutherland version is one of the most terrifying movies I've ever seen.
Right.
And just curious about some comments about it, if that fits into this.
I voted for that. I wanted to have that in our zombie. That in the original 50s versions are truly unnerving. And you know, some of this is the idea of infection. You know, anything that sort of goes past the skin barrier, whether it's Ebola virus sort of metaphor or radiation, but it's the idea of losing control and volition. And you know, all of these zombie type films are like that, and it's certainly that Invasion of the Body Snatchers, where you're literally sort of possessed, you know, almost metaphorically. Definitely.
So why did the rest of you vote her down?
It's all Jenny's fault, really.
Okay, Jenny's fault. Thanks. Next question. Carmen.
Well, I actually just had some interesting parallels that I was seeing. So in both the vampires and the zombie movies, the zombies and the vampires feast on human flesh and blood. And then as Christians, you know, in the Eucharist, we also, you know, consume the body of Christ and the blood of Christ. And then zombies are also kind of resurrected, and vampires seem to, you know, have eternal life. And, you know, so it's kind of an interesting parallel, you know.
No, it's very interesting. And Jeff, you have a comment about that. And by the way, if you read... No, I'm going to get to him. But there is, in early first century literature, there were accusations made against Christians that they were cannibals because they were eating and drinking bodies and blood. And this is a real critique of the culture around Christians in the first century. So this is really a very, very important point, Karin. And Jeff, what do you have to say?
Well, when the zombies resurrect, they are incomplete. I mean, they are less than they were. Christ reminds us that we will be more than we are. We will be what we were meant to be because of his body. We're dependent on his resurrected body. And at the same time, it does sort of remind us, though, that that's how low we are, is we must eat like that. But, you know, it is a fulfilled vision of partaking of body and blood where the zombies just, they lose what is the sort of glorified ideal image of God in men and women that most people don't realize that's what we call it, the image of God. They just think of it as some kind of mysterious human thing. But you see this again and again in other movies that don't seem like zombie movies or vampire movies, that seem more futuristic. Never Let Me Go, which is in theaters right now. The characters that are most human are these manufactured characters who live for the purpose of donating their body parts to keep rich people alive, which turns the rest of the human race into consumerist monsters. And you think, wow, what a far-fetched science fiction nightmare that must be. Well, what are a lot of scientists doing right now but studying how we can take the most vulnerable form of human life and exploit it in order to fight our own diseases so that we can live longer. You know, it's really not that far-fetched. Hmm. And so again and again, we're toying with this perversion of communion.
Nigel, you had a comment.
Yeah, I mean, isn't this what Mr. Nasty Screwtape does all the time? Not an original thinker at all. So he takes what is and turns it into something else. Constantly, all through history, he is changing the goalposts. He's a mask wearer. And not an original thinker, but brilliant, absolutely brilliant at creating the false and making it look the truth. There's no substantive, get the word out. You know, it's a lot of it is surface to look alike substance, but it actually doesn't have the organic of and the substance. We mentioned the infection. C.S. Lewis says in Mere Christianity that Christians are called to be a good infection. And in the first century, they were. See how they love one another. You know, this was a light, this was an agape, a good infection. And of course, Mr. Narcy has to come along and pervert that.
Yeah, thanks, Nigel. Anna Church.
Okay, my question is more for, I guess, the audiences of people who consume the film and literature. So do you think that people's fear of death is what fuels the popularity of the living dead being zombies and vampires?
Yeah, is it about fear of death in the audience, really, underneath it all?
What a good question.
When you're thinking about, you know, vampires and wanting to live forever, I think, especially in the vampire genre, you're toying again with... as Chris brought up, the sexual part of it, it's almost this desire to be loved and fully known by something that is greater than you. So, you know, Twilight's a perfect example of this, but some of these, in Werner Herzog's Nosferatu, there's a great scene where basically Mina, the main woman, Nosferatu says to her, you know, give me some of the love you have for your husband.
And she basically says, no, you know, no, that love is only for him. I won't even give that love to God. So there's this deep pull, I think, as these cultural shifts happen, to be known more fully. And this is the way we're sort of manifesting it.
Dick, can I add something to that?
Yeah.
I think the back to the smuggling idea, audiences want to be scared for their life. And I think that's what draws them in. There's something cathartic about the initial thrill of, oh my goodness, that thing could eat me. Oh, it's just a movie, and you walk away, you're okay, even if the main characters aren't. But the good storytellers show you that there's something even more dangerous than the mortal threat, and that is the lawmen who come in to take care of the monster, and something has died in them that is far more serious than just losing your life. You've lost your conscience and your heart.
And thanks, Jeff. Absolutely. Sorry, Nigel. Yep, we have to keep moving
off
here.
You go.
Jeff. I hope this isn't completely off topic a little, but it's a question that always comes up, and it speaks to what you just said, Jeffrey, about that audiences want to be scared out of their minds for whatever it is. And here's the question. Can rational analysis overcome the brain impact of highly charged emotional experience that bypass the frontal cortex? Can we think our way out of being imaginatively traumatized?
The audience did with The Exorcism of Emily Rose, and that's what impressed me about that film. Flawed as it was, I think that's what worked best there. But one of my favorite lines from Night of the Living Dead is, kill the brain and you kill the ghoul. As if, you know, as if just rationality is what's driving the zombies. They must eat to stay alive. They must kill to stay alive. That's their drive, is to just kill, 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 kill. We need something more than brain. We need something more than baser appetites. We need something that marries the two. Scott Cairns, in his book, calls it the noose, the place where the mind and the heart meet, which is what Scripture is talking about. Whenever it uses the word mind, like be transformed by the renewing of your mind, that's a cheap translation of a word that meant the marrying of mind and heart, and that's what's being lost in these films.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
No,
Chris.
I was just going to add briefly that you mentioned Night of the Living Dead, and by creating the African-American character as the hyper-rational, I was telling my husband that I was sort of flashing on Spock, that you had the sort of mid-60s white liberal, you know, kind of filmmakers creating a sort of anti-archetype of the hyper-rationalist minority character, who is this sort of other, who everybody else is kind of out of control, emotional, and, you know, sort of dangerously unhinged by their feelings, but he's the hyper-rational leader. And there's this sort of mid-20th century belief in science and rationality will save us. And it breaks down in the end. It doesn't.
There's Sorokin, the sociologist from Harvard, that talked about the fall of every great civilization. He says they begin ideationally. They have a vision. They have a sense of big, big ideas and values that are worth living and dying for. And they progress through to what he called the sensate culture, where they're basically just having sensations and experiences. And, of course, this is what Neil Postman was fearing in Amusing Ourselves to Death, that image and mediums were being used that were bypassing the rational processes. And so I think your question is a really important one. I mean, C.S. Lewis said, reason is the organ of truth, and imagination is the organ of meaning. And if you use imagination without attaching it to interpreting truth, but just to create a sensate experience, which certainly not all of the films we're talking about would do that, but some of them, I mean, I think that's what we're saying, some of them have basically just gone for sensation, for people to have a feeling and experience, but it doesn't get processed intellectually. And we've already said a good part of the audience probably doesn't do that. So it's kind of is a scary phenomena if you think about the sensate experience bypassing reason and not being processed by reason, but coming out with a really scary emotional experience.
Which underlines the importance of what you do, Jeff, which is theater, which demands the audience to participate in painting in the rest of the picture with their own imaginations. That will make that experience that much more personal. That's why Orson Welles said that giving them just a hint of a scene makes theater a social act, because it requires the audience to participate. And that's what we're killing in kids by giving them 3D and all of these sensory overload experiences. John Medina, the brain scientist who's at SPU and University of Washington, says the best thing you can do for your kid's brain is to give them a box of crayons and a cardboard box in 2 hours.
And so some Hostess Twinkies. Don't forget the Twinkies. By the way, I asked our panel just one person comment after each because we have so many questions and I don't want to make sure we get to them.
Sorry.
So, Nigel, take one of these and then be happy because I know you're just chomping at the bit.
If you let me.
Nigel, who could stop you? Ryan, what's your question?
As our youth come to idolize the dark and powerful natures of such evil topics, how are we going to share the light in the arts when they're no longer accepted?
Well, expand on what you mean by no longer accepted.
Well, I mean, like, as a youth, as a generation, as we come to like to see these things as power, things that we crave, are such topics of Christianity going to be relevant? I guess maybe even a topic of will religion ever outweigh science?
That's my question, Dick. Thank you, Ryan.
it wasn't, but Nigel's going to answer anyway.
No, go ahead, I'm Nigel. Not going to answer it. I'm going to speak to it.
Yeah. And by the way, Nigel and I are very, very dear friends.
Yeah.
Which is why Carla's going to edit out all of Nigel's comments. No, just kidding. Go for it, Nigel.
Do what you like. You know, we have withdrawn from the culture. Our great-grandparents pulled out of the culture. The culture was too painful for them. Now, did they withdraw in order to advance, or did they withdraw to talk to one another? And so we create a subculture where we talk to each other. But it's not a relevant voice. It's not a voice that this generation is wanting to listen to. It's not a voice that the questioner is wanting to listen to. So if you don't, the voices are not there, whose voices are there? If we stand on the touchline and tell everyone else how to play the game, we've got to teach our children to get into the game, to get have a voice in the marketplace, to be out there, not doing battle stuff, but to have a voice so that people can see, make a choice. In this supermarket world, there are thousands of choices. How do you choose? How do you choose? It's very easy to analyze what's going on in the culture. It's not easy to be a counterculture, to be out there in the culture with a voice, making the movies, writing the poetry, writing the novels, and all that. So I think we've withdrawn and we've lost our voice, and we need to be building for the next generation's voice.
Yeah, which is, it's like Christianity got locked into propositional when the whole rest of the world was moving towards imagination and exploring things differently. And so there's a lot of work to be done. Let's go next to Kathy.
So I heard a lot of reference to the light, but I wanted to know what specifically the light you mean by the light.
Oh, I like how Jeff's looking at me. The light, it's interesting because it kind of comes up in classes that I teach at SPU about film and faith. And there's so many ways that, you know, pointing us toward whether it's the Imago Dei, the image of God in human life, choosing a culture of creation and sanctification, even understanding suffering as a kind of sacred act. Robert Johnston, the theology professor down at Fuller, talks about chasing the sacred. And so some of the light, you know, it feels like not just lighting the candle in the darkness, but it's seeking after the what the shadows tell you you need. You know, how this, what the darkness teaches us about that need for the light. And so even if it's the crack in the window or a hopefulness or a kind of, you know, heartrending lesson about the brokenness of the, you know, the things that we choose, I always think that the light comes in even if the story is ostensibly dark or shadow-filled, because it always posits and points us toward the light on the other side.
It's what happens with the king in Hamlet. When he sees a horror story, he says, give me some light.
Exactly. It teaches that we want it. Exactly. But also that it's there. I don't think despair is what we're seeing in these stories. It's the need for redemption and the longing for hope and sometimes the promise of it.
Mm. Paul, your question.
Your significant other is turned by a family of vampires. Do you, one, kill the creature he or she has become and become a modern-day Van Helsing to avenge him or her, or two, join him or her and spend eternity on Earth feasting and building a family as a romantic gesture?
Ladies and gentlemen, a big round of applause for Paul. Jeff. Here.
You reject the possibility that there is such a thing as a vampire, which is irredeemable.
Oh.
Amen.
And you suggest that even a mass murderer of Christians might someday be a leader of the church. And that the grace of Christ, that nothing can come between us and the grace of Christ. So the idea of a vampire is scary because it's a lie.
Ah, Brian, amen. Good job, good Jeff.
Wow. Ooh, nicely handled.
Okay, mine's a whole lot easier. At what point is it just plain unhealthy to spend our time watching horror and evil that's going on?
Yeah, well, I go back to Jeff's question earlier about, how do we stop the saturation of the imagination in each of us? Is it unhealthy? Is the imagination being sapped out of our children, out of ourselves? Where is the wonder and the beauty of science? Where is the wonder and the beauty of anything? So again, I think this is their food. This is what is being put out there. You know, we may not like it. If we dislike it, who are the writers at the table? Who are the poets at the table? Who are the if we have any imagination in this room, then let's get it out there. Let's not just keep it for the closet. Let's get it out there. Let's work at it, skill it, and get it back out there. And maybe our great, if we plant a seed, our grandchildren may climb into the tree.
And as a Presbyterian, I just have to say, all things in moderation, Brian.
Okay. Joel.
Arnie, I just wanted some professionals to weigh on an old argument. Shaun of the Dead, romantic comedy, and perhaps the greatest romantic comedy.
Except for it has the bad girlfriend. Yeah. Sorry, yeah. Go ahead.
My friend Ron Reed, who directs plays in Vancouver, BC, called it the first rom-zom-com.
Nice.
Okay, Keegan.
All right. Did we cop out of that or what?
Yeah. Yeah.
I just wanted to ask if any of you had heard of The Walking Dead, which is a new show. It's going to be on AMC, is a network known for Mad Men, Breaking Bad, mm-hmm. some higher brow shows. That's going to be making a zombie show.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But added on to that, if you don't know about it, the thing that makes Walking Dead different, aside from being a comic book, is that the whole thing is that anybody, whether or not they're bitten by a zombie, becomes a zombie when they die. So mortality is it's brought much to the forefront. And just the idea that, you're not presented with, the mindless horde, you're just presented with death. Mm. And just a constant reminder that no matter what, you're gonna die.
Mm. So the only thing you become is a zombie? So it's not like reincarnation, some of you are ants and some of you are cows and some of you are zombies. Everybody's gonna be a zombie? Yeah. Why do you think, what does that mean?
I don't know. I wanted to hear what they think.
They don't know. Who wants to knock that one out of the park?
Well, I saw the trailers when I was watching the Mad Men season finale last night. And I'll tell you that I just told Keegan earlier that a lot of the imagery is very much copying 28 Days Later, even the opening scenes. It's very much sort of playing on that same apocalyptic. But Keegan, you were mentioning that, with mortality as the question more in play, that everybody's dead or that sort of death is your only option. I'd be curious to see how they're going to play that out.
Well, there's more and more discussion of keeping people alive, beyond natural boundaries. And I think I don't have the scripture reference handy, so I probably shouldn't even go here. But I think there's a verse about how in the end times, even death will be taken away from them. The suggestion that by being trapped in this particular fallen state, people will become more and more miserable and be unable to receive grace. I think that's a nightmare that's building in the culture as we seek immortality here and then look around and go, but why in the world would we want to stay?
And one scripture we might say, if Christ be not risen, we are of all people most miserable. But, the resurrection puts the alternative to death. You know, we don't worship a dead Jesus on a wooden cross or an impotent baby in a cradle. We worship a living Christ. And it is the living Christ that is our hope. Therefore, we can visit the dark, not in some kind of gratuitous, secret, nobody notices way, but we can disclose the dark. You know, Plato's cave is fascinating. Here is a guy chained with his back to the entrance of the cave, and he can't get loose. He's bowed, but on the wall in front of him is the flickering light of the entrance. But he cannot turn round. There is no release from this situation unless someone come and release him. Then he can walk out of the cave. There's no point in telling people that they're in the dark and stroking up the cul-de-sac of irrelevancy navel gazing over here. You know, someone has to go and strike a match, and somebody may see the exit. Hmm. But if there's no matches, there's no exit.
Sandy, your question.
Yeah, Nigel, I think your comments actually lead into my question. So what's the long-term effect of this prevalence of this genre? Is it disclosing the darkness so that we can see it more clearly, or is it really just desensitizing us to it so that we see darkness as folly?
Well, the answer is let the right one in, perhaps. I mean, to me, this all, it's very much about being judicious, maybe because I'm Presbyterian too, but the notion that, I don't love the genre, and I pick and choose, and I'm careful about the kind of narratives, and certainly gratuitous violence, as my children would tell you, Jurassic Park scared me, okay? So the notion of just kind of blithely consuming it, I'm thinking of Jeff's book, Through a Screen Darkly, talking about, you know, that it is food, and to not be gluttons or to indiscriminately sort of stuff your face, because this is powerful stuff that tells about dark and light. And so I would say really let the right one in.
The stories should grieve you. I saw 28 Days Later again the other night, and I was exhausted emotionally by the end of it. And then I went and watched Night of the Living Dead the next night to be ready for this. And I wish I hadn't, because I could hardly even think about it. I was so emotionally worn out. So if you have an appetite for another one the next day, that may be something to be concerned about.
test yourself.
Lyle, or an appetite for other humans. Lyle, your
even
question.
Worse.
I just want to drive the interrogative truck just a little further down Cannibal Road.
Please do.
Chili is a dish that has mysterious ingredients. Chili is also a country where there was an airline disaster where people consumed each other, the book Alive, the movie Alive. Recently, of course, there was the mine disaster where there were 33 men trapped, hopeless, underground. Mm-hmm. And the interesting revelation that came from that is during the time when they did not know that there was an escape or that someone would come find them, they never told a cannibalism joke. But afterwards, when they knew there was hope, I think Villarreal's looking pretty healthy over there. Maybe, you know, if something happens, we could slice him up. The cannibalism jokes didn't start till later. So what I'm saying, do we only examine our fears when it's safe, when we're safe to do that?
The Nebraska genius strikes again. Yeah, what do you guys say? Interesting question.
Well, the chili, I don't happen to like chili very much.
And I knew Nigel would go to the meat of the question.
Sometimes, sometimes you don't realize you're being given it, and you swallow it, and it does affect you in a certain kind of way, and you feel fearful about the infection, and you wonder, is it a good or a bad infection for a while? And then you get a release one way or the other from that. So I do think we should do our homework, and it does relate to the earlier question the lady asked at the same table as your good self. I think we should know the dark better than those who write about it. You know, it's an amazing thing that Jesus, after he died on the cross, went into hell. Hell can never say, the dark can never say, I never saw the light. Because the light has actually visited the darkest place. Now, to the extent that any of us in this room or anyone listening to the podcast knows their journey and is honest about the journey, then they can write about that. They can put that out there. They can come alongside others. Too often we come alongside people and say, I know what you're going through. Nobody knows what anyone else is going through. They know what they're going through. And what they're going through brings them alongside what someone else is going through as we listen and weep with one another. And I think we need to learn to do some weeping. You know, the whole world for 5 minutes felt for these miners underground. We felt for the Haiti earthquake. We felt for the Gulf situation. We're being given an awful lot of shaking today and a lot of opportunity to go to some of these dirty places and really get engaged with them and really understand with them. If we carry a glimmer, then we should be doing that on the streets of Seattle and everywhere else.
Good answer, Nigel. Chester, your question.
Are there any positive or redemptive depictions of Christians or Christian theology in these pop culture movies that are so popular? And if not, then why?
In 28 Days Later, the very first zombie that attacks the main character is a cleric, a priest. And I thought, oh boy, here we go. Might as well just put it, your cards right on the table. I know where you're going with your depiction of faith or the church. Watch the rest of the movie and especially listen to the rest of the movie. The music that keeps us from choking to death as we watch are the pieces of music that bring light into the darkness are hymns and are Ave Maria. And they keep some kind of aesthetic beauty going to give you hope in the harmony of the music and in the lyrics of the music. And I think that's very interesting because Danny Boyle will say that he's not a Christian. And when I asked him about how he made the movie Millions, which was full of saints giving this child hope in the middle of beastly human behavior, he said, oh, that was for my mom. She's a Catholic, and I knew that would mean something to her.
Like, yeah, well, and the only safe place in 28 Days Later is a ruined church in the countryside. They go to this ruined church, and it's the only sort of delight that they have in the whole movie. They see horses, and they're a family mm-hmm. together in a ruined church. So,
and even if they're attacking the church, like Guillermo del Toro likes to do, for good reason. He loves to tell a story about being raised by nuns, and when he went to them and said, there are monsters in my room, they said, shut up, don't talk about that anymore. And so he lived with these monsters. But when he tells stories, he doesn't want to have anything to do with those Christian myths. His stories are about these innocent people who put their lives on the line to save the vulnerable and who are welcomed into a magical kingdom that they always belonged to begin with and are practically told, well done, good and faithful servant.
Yeah.
And you're going, wow, you showed us.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, the
so
wonderful thing is God is not silent, is he, guys? He's really not silent, and he isn't waiting for the church. He's out there, you know, it's a long wait. Christopher Hitchens, who is a pronounced atheist, has said, I'm going to die an atheist. He's dying of cancer. I shall die an atheist. But if you care to pray for me, what's that? Can we get out of our skin, our human skin? We can blow our brains out like Ernest Hemingway because we can't have good sex, you know? But can we actually get out of our skin? And if any of you in this room believe that we're fearfully and wonderfully made, unpack that. If you recognize every single person in every restaurant, on every street corner, in every shop here as that, to the degree you understand that, then celebrate that with them. The waiter at the table. It actually makes economic sense. You'll get better meals and better service. But don't do it for economic sense. Do it because you care. You take time to care, and you recognize what they don't recognize in them. Love the image of God in every single human being, because that's light.
in however broken, however dark the situation is, that is bringing a light. It's not shoving a text on them. It's not shouting Jesus at them. It's enjoying and loving them. Love is the message of the first century and the message of the 21st century.
Can we have a round of applause for our special guest, Nigel Goodman? A man who practices what he preaches, because today he met a complete stranger at a Tully's that was working behind the counter and said, "I'd love to come, but I have to work till 9. And about 10 minutes later came up and said, "I got somebody to replace me." And he's here tonight, Ryan, formerly of Boise, Idaho. Now, I suspect Ryan, being the fine young man he is, would have given just as good a service had Nigel not shown interest. I believe that, but it never hurts. Let's have a final comment from each of you tonight about this subject. Jenny, why don't we start with you?
I think what Nigel said puts a point to it. It really is about love. These movies are a struggle for love, and we didn't get too deep into the vampire films, especially the older ones. It is that desperation to love, and it's love that destroys these vampires. It's light that destroys, I mean, literal light makes vampires burst into flame. It's love for people that helps the people in 28 Days Later come together. They realize what's worth surviving for is community and friendship and love and relationship. So I think that these ultimately can be a quest for a deep and abiding love.
Mm. Right. How about you?
And I would say, too, that, you know, similar comments about that they help us see the darkness, they help us see human brokenness, our need for redemption. But they're also powerful. I'll go back to the allegories and parables. They can be powerful societal narratives about political wrong. They can be about trusting military and the police and government when we shouldn't. And instead, the things like noble self-sacrifice, suffering. When a film we didn't mention was District 9, that also is a sort of really powerful allegory, of course, of South Africa, but also it has this sort of noble suffering for the greater good of your culture. And that's that sort of Christological, that Christ figure that I think is also deeply embedded in the best of these stories. Not mm-hmm. everyone, but the good ones.
Thank you, Dr. Christina. Christine Chaney.
Thanks.
And Jeff.
If you're worried about vampire and zombie movies, you've pretty much cut out about 90% of the stories that are being told on the big screen, including The Social Network, Stone, Never Let Me Go, on and on down the line. The Social Network runs on a story of two characters who founded Facebook, one of whom had a conscience, and the other one was something of a zombie. And Ephesians 5:11, which I was told again and again growing up, says, "Have nothing to do with the unfruitful deeds of darkness." So we should avoid these stories, right? Except that there's more to the verse. But rather expose them. Like a doctor who wants nothing to do with cancer, but he's going to expose it so we understand it, so we can avoid it, and hopefully save others from it.
I like that you brought Guillermo del Toro into the story, because they actually tried exorcisms on him because they found drawings of monsters. And he said, "If I have to choose between Jesus and monsters, I take monsters." And I think one of the points of tonight is that you don't have to choose between Jesus and monsters, because both of them are real and they are related, and we need to understand the relationship between them. This is Dick Staub, host of The Kindling's Muse. Thank you so much for joining us tonight. We'll look forward to seeing you next time on The Kindling's Muse.